Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Breaking news out of the White House late on a Friday is usually them trying to bury something. But when the president took to the podium this afternoon, it was more along the lines of a healthcare pep talk. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here on this Friday, everybody. It is the 17th of July. And that means Congress has about 15 working days left before it heads out of town for summer vacation. That's not a whole lot of time to overhaul an industry that's about 20% of the entire American economy. And the later the date gets, the higher the political stakes get. Hence the appearance in the Oval Office by the president this afternoon.
I've said that health insurance reform cannot add to our deficit over the next decade, and I mean it. Let me repeat. Health insurance reform cannot add to our deficit over the next decade, and I mean it.
Strong words, but no small promise, considering a health care overhaul could cost anywhere between $1 and $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years. But here's the dirty little secret. For all the political talk about people and their doctors, this whole health care debate, it's not really about you. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Remember Harry and Louise, that TV couple that helped kill the Clinton's health care reform bill in the 90s? Well, they're back. But this time, there's a twist.
Well, it looks like we may finally get health care reform.
It's about time.
Harry and Louise are now for overhauling the health care system. And their ads are being paid for in part by big drug companies. But wasn't overhauling health care supposed to be a bitter pill? Well, it turns out drug companies like this bill.
It's quite an expansion in coverage.
John Shields is a healthcare analyst at the Lewin Group.
That means a big increase in the number of people who will have access to prescription drugs.
And that's big money. The pharmaceutical industry is not giving up much either. Importing drugs from Canada is off the table, and the Senate's giving new biotech drugs 12 years of freedom from generic competition. Lobbyists for doctors and hospitals are also elbowing for concessions and getting them. Doctors' fees won't be subject to automatic price caps. Right now, the only industry that's really unhappy is insurers.
The insurance industry faces potential extinction, to be honest.
Stuart Butler at the Heritage Foundation says the publicly run insurance plan that's in the House bill could force most private insurers out of business. But for now, at least, nothing's final. Instead, the healthcare overhaul is a lobbying free-for-all. But wait, I think we've left out patients.
Oh, well, they always get left out.
In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The U.S. trade relationship with China is a complicated one, and climate change isn't making it any easier. The Chinese make a lot of the stuff we want to buy. That means their factories are putting out a lot of greenhouse gases on our behalf. Today in Shanghai, Commerce Secretary Gary Locke said American consumers should pay for the carbon content of what we consume. And that sounds simple, but of course, it's not. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
Accounting for the environmental costs of consumer products has long been the rallying call of environmentalists. Not anymore. This week, Walmart announced plans to measure the environmental impact of every product that hits its shelves. Even U.S. manufacturers are now on board. That is, as long as the climate legislation in Congress passes and as long as they're not the sole target. Scott Siegel is an industry lobbyist with Bracewell Giuliani.
What we're talking about here is making sure that Chinese goods don't have an unfair competitive advantage by virtue of the fact that their manufacturers haven't had to pay to control carbon.
Today's comments by Commerce Secretary Gary Locke in Shanghai confirms that even the White House may be reconsidering the idea of tariffs. David Victor is an international relations professor at UC San Diego. He says there's no way to make a dent in global emissions unless consumers pay the environmental costs of goods. But how do you determine those costs? He says it's one thing for Walmart to tell its suppliers to pony up emissions data.
It's another thing for a whole country to tell another country, the United States telling China, to report accurate data about the emissions that come from a whole bunch of factories across China that the Chinese government itself probably doesn't really administer very well.
Victor says the White House is most likely using trade tariffs as a threat to get China to reduce its emissions. But he says the problem with threats is that sometimes you have to act on them. And if that happens, he says the result would be an all-out trade war. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
The housing industry is today's example of economic reports that make your head spin. We learned this morning that new home construction is up and down, up from last month, way down from a year ago. Still, an index that measures confidence among home builders is up, and we were curious about where all that confidence is coming from. So we called Dean Mon. He's a real estate developer still going strong in northern New Jersey. Mr. Mon, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
I have to tell you, sir, we called around to a whole lot of people before we found somebody who was still building and selling houses. Why, with the inventory that's out there, are you still building?
Well, I think last year when the first-time home buyer tax credit was passed, and we're all excited that it was going to kind of stimulate the market. Some of us builders that had projects about to go in the ground kind of took a leap of faith and said, well, maybe we need to get started because this is going to stimulate demand. Unfortunately, because the first part of the credit was refundable, you had to pay it back to the government, the market really didn't get going until, I believe it was earlier this year, late last year, when it really they did away the provision that you had to pay it back. And we have seen a tremendous uptick, I think. All across the country pretty well, where builders are beginning to see the credit really working.
Define tremendous uptick for me.
I'll tell you my case. We opened up the project for sale in February, and today we have almost 21 contracts.
Who's buying? This is entry-level housing you built?
This is entry-level with appealing to teachers, nurses, some policemen, municipal workers. You know, the family's making between $30,000 to $80,000 a year.
I don't know if you'd heard, sir, but there's this credit crisis out there. You know, lending and financing have frozen up. Where are you getting your finance?
Well, I'm getting the what we call the AD&C, the acquisition and development. That is a problem, but I'm being very fortunate to work with my local bank. The community banks, are still lending to some extent.
What does the next 6 months look like for you in your particular part of the housing market?
I think it looks very good. Of course, we're going to come upon the December 1 deadline where the credit is going to go away. We're hoping that haven't seen how much job creation, because housing is about creating jobs. I know we uptick 100,000 housing starts, we create $300,000 to $400,000 jobs.
Yeah, when you saw those housing figures this morning, does that jive with your experience?
Yes, I was very excited because I think I'm not ready to say that we have turned the corner, but we certainly begin to peak around the corner.
Dean Mon, a builder and developer in northern New Jersey. Mr. Mon, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Across the Hudson River over in Lower Manhattan, the mood was a bit more mixed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. State-by-state unemployment figures came out today. Michigan saw its jobless rate top 15%. Unemployment hit 10% or more in 14 other places, including Florida. The housing bust in the Sunshine State means thousands of construction workers and realtors are out of a job. Now the layoffs are reaching government workers there, too. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports now on some of the cuts proposed in Miami-Dade County.
If there's a county where kids need public swimming pools, broiling hot Miami-Dade is it.
It felt like you're in an oven.
But the county's proposed budget would slash funding for 11 public pools, including this one. Instead of being open year-round, the Marva Bannerman pool would be open just 10 weeks a year. Linda Deal watches her grandson splash in the pool.
I don't really think that the economy is that bad that they should stop all these programs because they're underprivileged kids. They really need it.
Home values are in the tank across the county, meaning lower property tax revenue. That's burned a $427 million hole in the budget. Miami-Dade County came out with its proposed cuts this week. 1,700 employees would be let go. The rest would see a 5% pay cut. The $60 million a year spent on social services, arts, and culture would be slashed to zero.
That was a shock.
That's Daniela Levine. She runs the Human Services Coalition, a nonprofit that works with low-income families. It stands to lose $130,000 a year.
It's bad now. It's going to get worse.
for sure. People are being given the wake-up call.
The 13 Miami-Dade commissioners have until September 30th to approve the budget. Commissioner Katie Sorensen says the proposed cuts would have a ripple effect.
People are going to have mortgages that they won't be able to pay. They're going to have small businesses. They're not going to be patronizing, and the whole community is going to feel that.
Sorensen says she'd sooner raise property taxes than cut some services.
Number. Thank you.
Such as the 400,000 free meals served each year to impoverished senior citizens. 75-year-old Lottie Person volunteers at a senior center in Coconut Grove. She says the county better think twice about cutting those free meals.
Because they have me to deal with. They're going to see us on that county hall Tuesday, 5 p.m.
That's the first public meeting to debate the new budget. In Miami, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
As you consider the week's news, especially some of those earnings reports from the big banks, you might feel like wiping your brow and saying, whew, glad that financial crisis is over, huh? But really, is it? Here for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond is business writer Heidi Moore, also John Carney. He blogs for ClusterStock.com. Good to have you back, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Kai.
Heidi, you get first crack at bank earnings this week. Are you surprised that, you know, these guys are making billions of dollars again?
What I'm surprised at is the reaction to them making billions of dollars, which veers somewhere between, hey, look, the banks are great again. We don't have to worry anymore. Life is good. And a very sort of dark reaction of, well, these guys are still subsidized and it was TARP that got them there, which doesn't make any sense because you can't bail out the banks so that they're profitable. And then when they're profitable, turn around and say, hey, who authorized this?
John, what about you on the surprise part?
I'm not surprised. Banks have been able to borrow subsidized dollars thanks to a whole variety of programs. And when you can borrow cheaply, you can make a lot of money. A lot of things that wouldn't be affordable, investments you'd never make when you had to borrow expensive dollars, become much cheaper when you're borrowing basically on the backs of the taxpayers. It's sort of like if you had a credit card that was really cheap and you had a very low interest rate, suddenly a lot of items that you might not think that you could afford, you could go out and buy.
Yeah. So is there disagreement here between you and Heidi, John?
Yeah, I think I might be one of the dark forces Heidi was talking about.
That's why we have you on, man.
I'm suspicious about the true health of the banks, for instance. They can make a lot of money, but that's not really a sign of either broader economic health or their own health, since they are borrowing money with government backing. Goldman Sachs borrowed tens of billions of dollars that was government-backed, which means that if they ever defaulted on it, once again, the taxpayers would have to come in and bail them out.
Yeah, I'm actually really sorry to disappoint you, John, but we actually agree. the banks are not in good shape, and a lot of the quote unquote profits that they're making are on the back of mortgage-backed securities, trading those old risky businesses, and from just changes in accounting rules that allow them to put different values on assets that they owned before. So nothing's changing really to create this profitability, and you're seeing a lot of one-time events that are giving the banks more money. Like, for instance, Citigroup booked something like $7 billion from selling its wealth management arm to Morgan Stanley. Yeah. So that's never going to happen again, and you're never going to see that boost again.
Heidi, let me take a detour into the politics of all this. Former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson was on Capitol Hill yesterday defending to the hilt his role in the Bank of America Merrill Lynch deal. One of the things he also said, though, in essence, was, I'm really proud of what we did last fall in saving the economy. You buying that?
Yeah, I think he's proud of it. I think the congressmen are still a little confused about what happened there. And it was very clear that not only have they not gotten the memo this time around, they didn't really get the memo back in September because one of the congressmen asked Hank Paulson something like, you never really made it clear what you meant when you said there would be a financial meltdown.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just one of those phrases that doesn't seem like there's a lot of room for interpretation. You know, it's the apocalypse. What more do you need to know? But it's very clear that now that things are sort of more stabilized, there is a huge forgetfulness of just how dire things were last September when Lehman Brothers was falling apart, when, you know, deposits were at risk, when business loans were at risk. We basically have the memory of goldfish. You know, I mean, it's like 15 seconds later and we're like, hey, what's that fern over there? You know, so it's really a problem.
John, if I'm right, Paulson's got a book coming out in October, which is probably the next time we're going to hear from him on the record of all this. How will we look at Henry Paulson and the late Bush administration in the future?
I do think that as time goes on, Paulson is going to emerge as a hero. I'm not sure he completely deserves that status. And I may be one of the goldfish that Heidi Moore is talking about. I am skeptical about the cause and effect here. I'm not sure that pumping lots of money into the banks really did very much good at all. What really healed our wounds was time.
John Carney at ClusterStock.com. Heidi Moore as well. Thanks, guys.
Great to talk to you, Kai.
Thank you.
Coming up, why beans fare better than beef in Argentina.
Because Argentines don't eat soybean, the government has hampered less that production. So a lot of land dedicated to cattle has shifted towards soybean.
But first, let's do the numbers. Not much of a day, really, but a heck of a week. The Dow Industrials picked up a third of 1%, 32 points, closed at 8,743. The NASDAQ traded nearly flat, picked up just a point, finished at 1,886. The S&P 500 was also flat, flat the other way, though. Lost a fraction of a point, ended the day at 940. In case you didn't notice, the bulls were running all week on Wall Street. The Dow charged up 7.33% since Monday. The NASDAQ grew by 7.4%. The S&P 500 packed on, wait for it, 7%, even though this time for the week. Citigroup surprised the market, as we mentioned, with better-than-expected quarterly earnings, but its shares fell a third of 1%. Bank of America gave back more than 2% today on rising concerns over consumer credit. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 3.65%. Oh, and by the way, you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. You can meet people talking about today's news at news.gather.com. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The House Energy and Commerce Committee meets for a third time to mark up America's Affordable Health Choices Act. National Poker Week continues. Organizers aim to get a message to lawmakers that online poker should be licensed and regulated. And on Earth, we mark the 40th anniversary of man's first walk on the moon. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Today was the last official day of Sonia Sotomayor's confirmation hearings, and from her perspective, it seems to have been smooth sailing. But if we hadn't heard it before, the news-consuming public certainly got its fill of the phrase wise Latina this week. Judge Sotomayor apologized for any misunderstanding. She tried to put the comments into context. But commentator Betsy Stevenson says the nominee may not be all that different from the rest of us.
Supreme Court nominee Sotomayor's comments about her life experience as a wise Latina have been juxtaposed against those of Chief Justice Roberts, who once said that a judge's job is to call balls and strikes, like a baseball umpire. The implication is that Roberts is unbiased, since most people believe that umpires are impartial. Certainly umpires make mistakes, but these mistakes are not driven by their race or ethnicity. But is this right? Researchers agree that it's difficult to sustain bias in professional sports arenas, but they also believe, like the old adage about New York, if bias can make it there, it can make it anywhere. So two separate teams of economists recently studied baseball umpires, and they learned something pretty startling. An umpire is more likely to call strike than ball when he's of the same race or ethnicity as the pitcher. And as a result, your team is more likely to win if the umpire is the same race as the pitcher. In sports, unlike the Supreme Court, there's an objective truth. And by comparing these umpires' calls with the pitch location data recorded by computers, researchers confirmed that it's the umpire making mistakes, favoring his own group. Similar research analyzing basketball referees also found that fewer fouls are called against white players when the refs are also white. These three independent studies all find evidence of biased decision-making in a highly scrutinized arena with clear right and wrong answers. If our biases trip us up, even when making simple decisions like calling ball or strike, foul or charge, then I really worry about how they may affect the more complex judgments made by any Supreme Court justice. Whether he admits it or not, a wise white man brings a different perspective to the bench, just as much as a wise Latina woman. Biases exist. Problems arise when we're unaware of them. If we acknowledge our bias, we can work to override it. But by ignoring the reality, we will continue to tilt our calls towards those who look like us.
Betsy Stevenson teaches at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Take a moment to send us your thoughts about baseball, the courts, whatever. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. There was some rare good news for the Argentine economy this week, a huge boost in its trade surplus. About 40% of that boost came from food exports, but still, Argentine farmers aren't happy. They worry that Argentina may soon have to import beef and wheat for the first time in decades. A severe drought is part of the problem, but the farmers say government policies aren't helping either. Ian Mount reports now from Buenos Aires.
The start of sales at Argentina's biggest cattle auction, the Mercado de Liniers. A scrum of buyers bids on some of the 10,000 animals in the stalls and stalks the yammering auctioneer. But ranchers say business is bad. Roberto Matarazzo Sord has 25,000 acres in northern Argentina. He complains beef prices have stalled for 3 years, well, his costs have gone up some 20% annually. He's going to have to cut his herd substantially.
We estimate that in 1 or 2 years, we'll probably go from 6,000 head of cattle to 3,000.
Matarazzo blames the agricultural policies of Argentine President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and her predecessor and husband, Néstor Kirchner. Facing 20% inflation and spiraling food prices, they imposed price controls on food. They also place strict controls on exports of staples like wheat and beef. For Fernandez de Kirchner, the idea is to take care of Argentina's poorest citizens.
As president of all Argentines, when I defend the interests of all citizens, I must prioritize the interests of those who live on only one paycheck.
Her policies get a lot of support from people in the poorer districts surrounding Buenos Aires. Hilda Lopez is president of the municipal council in Hurlingham, a Kirchner stronghold.
What the farmers have to do is set reasonable prices for domestic consumption and then export what's appropriate.
But economist Federico Thompson says Kirchner's policies have had the exact opposite of their intended effect. A recent study indicated that less wheat will be planted this year than at any time since 1897. The export controls are forcing farmers to drop wheat and beef for crops that they are allowed to export at a decent profit.
Because Argentines don't eat soybean, the government has hampered less that production, so a lot of land dedicated to cattle has shifted towards soybean.
The amount of land turned over to soy has doubled over the last decade. And ACREA, a research group that studies Argentine agriculture, says that over the past year, the number of cattle in Argentina has fallen by about 5%. Problem is, Argentines are the world's biggest beef eaters. each consumes about 150 pounds of beef a year. At this rate, Argentine farmers soon won't be able to produce enough for the local market.
Well, I think it'll be quite a disaster.
Malcolm Rodman is a fourth-generation rancher who sits on the beef committee of a local farmers' union. He says disaster will probably be averted. Argentines may end up eating more chicken, and some farmers, like Rodman, will probably try to tough it out.
We try and not go down with the amount of cattle because we know it'll turn over sooner or later.
What Rodman really wants is more farmer-friendly policies and fewer export restrictions. But in the present global downturn, Argentina's government may not be ready to drop the strict export limits and high export taxes that are giving farmers headaches. In Buenos Aires, I'm Ian Mount for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note, this being a Friday afternoon, it's time for a break from the big economic news of the week. Instead, we're going to let Rico Galliano and Brendan Newnham loose to do what they do. That is, ask the Marketplace staff about the stories that didn't make the headlines.
Deb Clark, senior producer of Marketplace Money, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, you know Anna Wintour of Vogue. She's decided in these tough economic times that we need to be reminded of, quote, just how wonderful shopping can be.
I think we need a reminder of how we're supposed to shop without any money.
Well, here's a thought. She may not actually be in touch with the common man. But anyway, Fashion's Night Out, she's organizing. It's going to happen in Paris, China, Rome, stores with late hours and special events.
And first we have to be able to afford to go to any of those cities, right?
Yeah, and I think she's probably not going to offer scholarships.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, what's your story?
Some French travel agencies are trying to encourage people to travel during the recession by offering sunshine insurance. If you have 4 days of rain during your trip, they will send you a check in the mail.
Did you hear that, Seattle? You better bone up on your French. Stock up on cigarettes and bread. The French tourists are coming.
Jeremy Hobson, New York reporter, go.
A couple of security officers and baggage handlers at New York's JFK were arrested for stealing luggage.
The whole bags?
The iPods and the laptops inside them. And then they ripped off the baggage tag so it would be harder to trace the violated bag.
But the obvious solution is you deploy more security guards to watch the other TSA security guards, right?
Yeah, maybe that would solve the unemployment problem in the country.
And then pretty soon, there would be more security guards than passengers.
I think that's already the case.
That is just a taste of what Rico and Brendan can do. You can hear more of it on their podcast. It's called The Dinner Party Download. And there is, of course, a link on our homepage. It's marketplace.org. And that, on this Friday afternoon, is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 32 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ added a point. We'll call that flat. The S&P 500 lost the point. We'll call that flat as well. You win, you lose, you're flat. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Ure. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, you remember when ATMs were new? Well, now the bank might even come to you.
Having financial access wherever you are, I think, is very much the next big thing.
And we will be back Monday afternoon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us.
Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.